morning and welcome. This is the time set for oral argument and rehearing en banc in the case of Gabby Lemos versus County of Sonoma. Counsel, before we begin, since you are both on video and appearing virtually, I just wanted to explain that each judge will have an opportunity to ask a question. They will identify themselves to hopefully make it easier for you when they begin to answer, when they begin to ask the question, and hopefully that will allow you the ability to recognize them and so that they can proceed and you can answer their questions. So we will see how that goes, and hopefully you'll have an opportunity to argue your case, and all the judges will have an opportunity to ask the questions that they'd like to ask. So with that, if the appellant is ready to begin, you may state your appearance.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Isaac Schweiger. May it please the court, I represent plaintiff appellant Gabby Lemos. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. The majority fundamentally erred in upholding the district court's application of HEC and the subsequent granting of summary judgment, because success on appellant's 1983 action here does not necessarily imply the invalidity of her conviction for Penal Code Section 148. The majority's error stems from the untenable position that the criminal jury necessarily determined the lawfulness of the deputy's acts throughout the entire encounter, despite the fact that the jury was presented with 4 distinct theories of liability by which they could find Ms. Lemos guilty, only one of which involved the use of force and required a finding that the use of force was lawful. The other 3 theories of liability were separate in time and in place from the use of force event, which forms the basis of Ms. Lemos's lawsuit. The jury was further instructed that their verdict must be a unanimous decision as to which act or acts form the basis of the conviction. And because the jury returned only a general guilty verdict without being asked to specify which theory or theories of liability they had adopted, it is impossible to tell now the factual basis of that verdict.
This is Judge Hurwitz. Let's assume in this case that instead of being instructed as the jury was, the judge just instructed the jury on the law and told them to look at the facts of the case and determine whether or not your client had violated Section 148. Would your view be different about whether or not there was a heck bar?
Well, my argument would definitely be different.
Of course. I want to know what your view would be.
Candidly, Your Honor, I'm not certain. I think that there's an argument that can be made with less strength than the one that we're presenting to the court now, that because there were multiple different instances within this encounter that were argued by the prosecutor as constituting a violation of 148, that it would still not necessarily be clear from the record. However, with the facts presented here being slightly different, that's not precisely our argument, it's just part of it.
I guess what I'm trying to get at here is, under that circumstance, would you look at the facts of the case or merely at the instructions given to the jury?
I think you'd have to do both, Your Honor. And I believe, you know, some of the cases that both parties have cited actually had factual hearings to determine whether or not HEC would apply before summary judgment was finally ruled on. In this case, we don't have that. We did not have a factual hearing. We're here only to decide on the basis of the record as it exists now whether or not HEC is applicable.
Thank you.
Counsel, this is Judge Callahan. You rely on Hooper versus City of San Diego, but isn't that case distinguishable because it involved excessive force occurring after the defendant had been restrained and stopped resisting? I have another component to this, though. It says, can you point to us to any case in which the court has held that HEC does not bar an excessive force case claim based on the officer's pre-arrest conduct where the plaintiff has been convicted by a jury for violating Section 148A? you sort of get where I'm coming from on this, because obviously everything occurred before she was handcuffed. So can you distinguish, is why I see Hooper as somewhat distinguishable, and I'm looking for a case that says there isn't a heck bar when it's all pre-arrest conduct.
Well, I think Smith actually supplies the court with that factual scenario, or at least such was discussed by the court. But because in Smith, we have a lot of pre-arrest conduct, including not taking the plaintiff's hands out of his pocket, not walking to the police officer, re-entering the home. All of this happened before the arrest. And in Smith, that's exactly what was argued. He entered a plea, was found guilty, and then later when he brought suit, said, well, I pled to something that didn't involve the use of force. I pled to those events before the use of force occurred during my actual arrest. So I think Smith does provide exactly that factual backdrop, or at least such was contemplated.
But the use of force here is really, it's so integrated into what happens before your client is down on the ground and being handcuffed.
I disagree respectfully, Your Honor. We have three theories of liability, which are separate in time significantly from the actual use of force event. The only theory of liability, specifically as it was presented by the prosecutor, that Ms. Lamos pulled away when the deputy attempted to grab her, that's the only one that's connected in time and in place to the use of force event. There's, as my calculations show, about 6 minutes of time between the first three theories of liability having occurred, those factual events, and the actual use of force event, during which time Ms. Lamos was removed from the presence of Deputy Holton and in the presence of a different deputy where she was, I feel as the dissent appropriately noted, where she was calm and cooperative with the deputies at that time, so that any criminality that had existed in the first three events had been separated and was not related in any way to the use of force event that followed.
And it wasn't Deputy Holton quite clear that when he arrested her, he was arresting her for her earlier interference and not for resisting arrest during the takedown, essentially.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So the arrests were not for the takedown, any resistance that occurred during the takedown.
That is my understanding, Your Honor. I suppose someone could argue that probable cause may have existed for an arrest for subsequent events. The record is clear that the intent of the deputy was to arrest Ms. Lamos for events which occurred prior to the use of force.
I have one more question, which is, although we wouldn't need to decide it in this case because, as you say, there were three other events, even as to the takedown period, what went to the jury was that she pulled back when he tried to stop her. Now, first of all, she also did that at the time, the deputy says she did that at the time that she was at the door of the car, so it's not entirely clear which pulling back they were talking about. But assuming they were talking about, as you've assumed, the one just before the takedown and asserted excessive force, I still don't really understand why the excessive force allegation is related to the very specific prior pulling away. In other words, she pulled away, and no one's asserting there was any excessive force in trying to pull her. And it was after that that the excessive force assertedly occurred. So I'm not sure whether you're conceding that piece was heck barred, but was it heck barred? Even that piece?
Well, Your Honor, presents an interesting question. I think Judge Callahan would say that's temporal hair splitting. And there's a strong argument for that. But then again, in the Hooper case, we have Judge Fletcher who tells us that in 45 seconds of time, we can have an event where there's legitimate resistance that forms the basis of a criminal conviction and still separate that out from an excessive force event, giving rise to civil liability, which happens later. So I hate to pass the buck and perhaps I won't, Your Honor, but I don't think I can split those hairs between those two schools of thought. I would adopt for my client in this case exactly what Your Honor suggests, that the use of force comes after the resistance and is unreasonable in relation to the resistance that was experienced.
If it was all vaguer, and because while she was down, he kept saying, "You're resisting arrest." So the force used during that period would have been barred if that were the basis for the conviction, but we know it wasn't, because it was, even as to that, it was specified that it was pulling her arm back and not any resistance that she offered during the actual takedown arrest.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, this is Judge Forrest. I have a question about the record. In the complaint, the allegation of excessive force seems to be both the shove at the truck and then also the takedown later. But your argument and briefing is focused just on the takedown. Have you abandoned the allegation of excessive force of what happened at the truck?
We probably would abandon that should the case proceed forward, Your Honor. At the time that this lawsuit was filed, a plaintiff did not have the benefit of having access to any of the body-worn camera footage. No discovery has been undertaken in this case because the civil case was stayed during the pendency of the criminal case. Now, with the benefit of that body-worn camera footage, that's likely a claim the plaintiff would abandon. I think for purposes of our argument here, I'm comfortable saying that that's how we would proceed if the grant of summary judgment were reversed, that the allegation of excessive force would not include anything that occurred outside of the takedown, which resulted in Ms. Lemos's injuries.
So then, just to be clear, you are abandoning that other theory?
Fair, Your Honor, yes.
Counsel, this is Judge Murkia. I'm curious, who asked for the jury instruction separating out Lemos's conduct, your client's conduct, into four distinct acts, or the events that occurred into four distinct acts? Was it the prosecution or the defense?
It was the prosecution. I believe there was not an objection from the defense, and I believe that that position was supported by the trial judge as well.
This is Judge Fletcher. Were you the trial attorney?
I was, Your Honor.
As I read the trial record, as the jury instructions are being considered, the fourth instance of conduct, which is to say pulling the arm away, as I read that, the pulling arm away was addressed to pulling the arm away while she was at the truck, not pulling the arm away as she walked past him 5 minutes later. I mean, I'll just read this. Your last bullet point stated, pull away from Deputy Holton when he attempted to handcuff her on the side of the truck. So I'm not sure that the pulling away as she walks by him is actually what you're now representing. I think you have a good argument either way, but I don't think you need to say that that fourth one, the pulling away, is that issue, because pulling away, as at the jury instruction, was pulling away at the side of the truck.
Whether or not that appears in the briefing, Your Honor, my best recollection of the case, being perfectly candid with the court, is that the argument, and unfortunately that's not part of our record, but that the argument that was presented by the district attorney involved the action of pulling away as Ms. Lemos was going back to her home. I do believe we have a prevailing argument either way, but I want to be perfectly candid with the court. That is my recollection.
Okay.
This is Judge Callahan. I saw somewhere something that the mother was charged with 148-2 at some point, but it didn't say what happened on that.
I'm happy to expound on that, Your Honor. Ms. Lemos's mother was arrested and charged in the same proceeding. They proceeded as co-defendants to trial. Both were convicted.
So she was a co-defendant with her daughter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
Counsel, this is Judge Owens, next to Judge Callahan. I'm curious about a different issue that hasn't been briefed, so I don't want to surprise you with it here. But in the answer to the complaint, the sheriffs and the city raised the issue of qualified immunity. And we have the option to affirm on any ground based on the record. And I was curious if, I know it hasn't been briefed before our court, but what is the case authority that you would point us to if we were to consider qualified immunity, what would the case authority point us to show that Officer Holton or Deputy Holton was on notice that his actions were just, you know, beyond the pale?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it's a basic application of the Graham factors. And that we know that, you know, force that is likely to cause serious bodily injury, say intermediate force, and I think in this case, Deputy Holton's use of force could properly be deemed intermediate, that is only going to be appropriate in a case where there's active resistance. When we're talking about the difference in size of these individuals, the difference in strength, we have Ms. Lamos at 105 pounds barefoot in her pajamas. She's 18 years old. We have a deputy who's 250 pounds.
Well, I'm kind of similar size to your client, but I have to say those women were pretty formidable. It was pretty scary when you're the only one, and they were, when you watch the video, they were, I think that was pretty negative towards your clients.
Well, I don't think it helps them, Your Honor, any. But at the same time, I would say that by the time the use of force event occurred, Deputy Holton was not the only one on scene. He had backup there and more backup that was arriving. Furthermore, I would say that a 105-pound 18-year-old girl in her pajamas barefoot does not pose the kind of threat that warrants the response that Deputy Holton visited upon her. And certainly her injuries are testament to that.
This is Judge Hurwitz. I just wanted to ask a question about qualified immunity. Did the county move for summary judgment on qualified immunity?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I would just add, I don't believe that, you know, they're going to be foreclosed to do that at a later time, because we had a specific agreement that they could bring an early motion for summary judgment just specifically to this very issue. Just a very, very quick moment, Your Honor. I want to make sure that I'm addressing
the jury's verdict necessarily determines the lawfulness of the officer's action throughout the whole course of the defendant's conduct.
Well, I think it's wrong, Your Honor. And I do think that that should be clarified, because at least in this very case, that simply did not happen. Whether it could apply in another case, as I think it does say in Beats, where we have only one distinct theory of liability. Therefore, when the jury votes guilty, they have decided that all of the officer's conduct in that period of time encompassed by that one theory of liability is lawful. Here, that's just not the case. So whether or not it's applicable in every case, I think it's not, plainly, because it's not here. Whether it's applicable in other cases like Beats, I think that it probably is. So I don't know if the rule needs to be overturned so much as it needs to be clarified, changed.
But this is Judge Hurwitz again. This is why I asked the initial question. If the jury had only been instructed to look at all the facts and determine whether or not your client was guilty, it seems to me footnote 5 might come into play. But that's not this case, is it?
It's not, Your Honor, and we'd be presenting a different argument. Though I think there's still an argument to keep the case in the fight, so to speak, because of the multiple acts that were argued by the prosecutor as being sufficient by themselves to establish a conviction.
This is Judge Fletcher speaking. Didn't the California Supreme Court change the construction of this relevant California statute 148A in Yount so that the footnote in Smith, footnote 5, is premised upon the earlier construction? And now that we have Yount, I think that footnote's just wrong.
I think Your Honor is correct in that regard. That's exactly what Yount said. As we know, the language in Yount allows for a single event to contain both criminal liability for the criminal defendant as well as civil liability for the arresting officer. And so to the extent that this court's past jurisprudence relied on a different interpretation of California law, perhaps moving forward, it should be different than that.
This is Judge Friedland again, but would it help clients or parties in this area to clarify that?
Oh, unquestionably, I believe that it would, Your Honor. I think everyone on both sides of any of these arguments would benefit tremendously from that clarification.
This is Judge Fletcher again. Could you respond to something that was in the panel opinion that differentiates between both Smith versus City of Hemet and the Hooper case on the ground that this was a trial rather than a plea. Should that make a difference?
Logically speaking, Your Honor, I don't see how it does. But even the majority in our last opinion, I believe that they said that it really is not the central inquiry. It really doesn't matter that much. What matters is whether you can tell from the record what formed the basis of the conviction. And I believe, I actually had that section highlighted, Your Honor, I believe it's page 13 of the opinion. They say that, sorry, I'm paraphrasing, but they say that such is not the central inquiry. It is, however, the chief difference between the case at bar and the cases that are cited in our briefs.
But if, for example, as I think in Sanders, which is the most recent case, there was a plea which specified as the factual basis three different incidents, then all of those incidents would be looked at. But if for example, there were just two, then the even in the plea agreement circumstance, you would know what it was that was the basis for the conviction, and you could proceed from there.
That's correct, Your Honor. As the court, I'm sure, is aware, California does not require a factual basis to be agreed to for a misdemeanor plea. So most of our misdemeanor pleas and most existing cases will be misdemeanors. We'll be silent as to that. But if there is such a plea that specifies the factual basis of it, then certainly it stands to reason that a plea by itself could still result in a heck bar. So I don't think it's outcome determinative whether or not a case, a finding of guilt resulted from a verdict or from a plea.
Counsel, this is Judge Lane. I think you may have touched upon this, but if you could clarify, if you view this incident as one continuous event, can you still prevail?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that we could. But I, frankly, it's not the case that we have. The factual pattern in Susick, actually, it kind of is one continuous event. And I know that we're not really relying on Susick too much because those holdings have been revisited. But what in Susick, we had a long string of constant resistance starting from the gentleman jumping in the car as it's going to be towed away, to refusing to get out, to running back to the office, to fighting with the officers while they're trying to handcuff him. That is an example of a continuous stream of resistance. And in that kind of a case where you can't find a break, you really can't, or at least you'd struggle to, then certainly it's a different issue than what we're facing here. But here we do have, as the dissent noted, a period of 2 to 3 minutes in time. And it's captured on the video, unequivocally, uncontroverted, that during those 2 to 3 minutes' time, Ms. Lemos was calm, and she was cooperative with Dillian, who was on the scene.
But I thought you were saying earlier, and it seems more productive to me, that the question isn't what judges after the fact think to characterize whether there's a continuous set of events or not, but how the case went to the criminal jury and what it decided. That's the key factual question, isn't it?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
So whether we call it a continuous stream of events or not a continuous stream of events is really not the pertinent question. This is Judge Berzon, by the way, I didn't say so. And so it's not a question of stepping back as a judiciary matter and saying, is this a continuous stream of events? It's a question of figuring out what the criminal conviction was for.
Yes, I think that's correct, Your Honor.
This is Judge Fletcher again. I'm not sure I agree with you that even if this were to be considered a continuous stream of events, which I think on the facts of this it's not, I think Yount tells us even if it is a continuous stream of events, nonetheless, you can have both a 1983 violation and a violation of 148A. That's what Yount says.
Yes, Your Honor. And to the extent I said otherwise, Your Honor is absolutely correct. I think I was trying to point out that it would be a different case. But I believe Yount does stand for that proposition that during one continuous course of events, we can have both liabilities present, both criminal.
Counsel, this is Judge Bress. If the jury had been instructed in this case that it had to find that the officer acted lawfully throughout the course of the interaction, would that have been a proper instruction under California law?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I've kind of tossed this around myself as a criminal practitioner, and it would necessarily imply, if that was the case, that a defense to Section 148 would be that at any time during the encounter, the officer acted unlawfully. And that's not the state of the law. As I mean, it's just not. We can have an officer acting unlawfully for 2 seconds of a two-hour encounter, and that would not invalidate an arrest or a conviction for resisting that occurred during that time. So, no, I don't think that would be a correct statement of the law.
Mr. Schweiger, I have a question based on your response to Judge Forrest. I think I understood you to say you're no longer asserting claims based on what happened at the truck. Do you think that you could assert such claims at the same time that you're asserting claims for the later takedown? That is, consistent with Heck, could you bring a 1983 action alleging that there was excessive force in both of those events?
Yes, Your Honor, but it would be a much closer closer question. And I don't mean to suggest, I'm speaking purely academically here, having reviewed the video, we know that the event at the truck is not anything that we're going to pursue as far as civil liability at this point.
But why could you bring both? Because, it seems like that between the two of them, that covers all four theories of criminal liability. So if you were to prevail on both, wouldn't that imply the invalidity of the conviction?
It would be a closer question. But because, Your Honor, there are three different events which occur during the first 3 minutes, and frankly, within about 60 seconds of each other, if we're being very generous. And those three theories of liability were making physical contact with the deputy while he was trying to open the truck, placing herself between the deputy and her sister, and blocking the deputy from opening the truck door. Even if we were to be pursuing a claim for excessive force based on the interaction at the door, those three events, while very much closer in time than the use of force here, don't necessarily implicate the use of force at the door. That is specifically Deputy Holden grabbing on to Ms. Lamos. It's a closer issue for certain, and it's not one we're going to pursue, but I don't think it would be categorically foreclosed.
Did you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Please, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Osmond. Please state your appearance.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Richard Osmond. I'm with Bertram Fox, Elliott, Osmond, and Lenzel. We're counsel for appellees, Sonoma County, former Sheriff Steve Freitas, and Deputy Marcus Holden. May it please the court. So Ms. Lamos was convicted of resisting, delaying, and obstructing on August 31st of 2016, and then sued Deputy Holden, the county, and the sheriff in a civil rights action alleging excessive force. The district court and the Ninth Circuit panel both got it right and applied the Heck bar to the civil action based on the applicable law and
perhaps
the extent.
You could, this is Judge Callahan. Perhaps you can help us because we spent a lot of time on the jury instructions. So the appellant argues that the specific jury instructions given in Ms. Lamos' criminal trial suggest that the Heck bar does not apply. So can you give us your perspective on how the jury instructions impact our analysis here?
Yes, certainly. So the jury was given 2656, which...
Were you trial lawyer as well as?
I was not. I do not practice criminal law at all. So, they were instructed.
Tell us a little about criminal law right now. So, go ahead.
They were instructed with 2656 regarding resisting arrest, and it said that it requires the people to prove the defendant willfully resisted, obstructed, or delayed a peace officer who was lawfully performing their duties. And then that instruction refers to 2670, which then specifies that the jury cannot find Ms. Lamos guilty if the people fail to establish that Deputy Holden was lawfully performing that same instruction 2670 goes on to say that you look at whether he was using unreasonable or excessive force when making or attempting to make an otherwise lawful arrest or detention. So,
wait, the statute is not limited to arrests or detentions or resisting anything. The 148 encompasses delay, obstruction, and the duties, and the duties can include investigation. So, although the last thing that occurred here was an arrest, the jury wasn't instructed that because the statute isn't limited to resisting arrest. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. The instruction in that one example, that one part, talks about a lawful arrest or detention, but it is the officer's duties, lawfully performing his duties. You're correct.
And that's critical here because three of the four incidents on which they were instructed did not involve an arrest.
I don't know that it's critical here because there are two different things that are happening here. One, we're assessing appellate's conduct, which is a continuing course of conduct. The jury instruction did split it out into four different subparts of one act. The other jury instruction is specifying that the officer had to have acted lawfully. And then the instruction goes on and talks about the Graham v. Connor factors and says that you have to look at under all the circumstances known to him, giving careful attention to the totality of the facts and circumstances, and the reasonableness inquiry is whether the officer's actions are objectively reasonable in light of the facts and circumstances.
So this is Judge Person. So is your view that the jury could have convicted for just one of the four incidents in which there was no excessive force but had to consider whether there was excessive force at some other time than when that incident occurred?
Based on these instructions, the jury had to determine the lawfulness of Deputy Holton's force throughout the entire incident.
Well, I'm reading the instruction. You may not find the defendant guilty unless you all agree that the people have proved that the defendant committed at least one of the following acts of resisting, obstructing, or delaying a police officer. So wasn't the jury rather clearly instructed that they only had to find that there was one illegal act by Ms. Lemos?
One of those four.
Those four. And then in light of that, how can you read the rest of the instruction to say that by finding that she committed one illegal act, you're also finding that the police officer acted legally during the balance of the incident for which you found that she committed an illegal act? I just don't see that in the instructions at all.
Well, the 2656 specifies Ms. Lemos's conduct.
Now, I'm looking at the 2670 instruction. The 2670 instruction doesn't say it's a defense if you prove that he acted lawfully throughout the transaction. It says, with respect to the acts, a police officer may detain someone if he knows the following. So I'm not sure how I can read that as saying that the jury was asked to find that he acted legally throughout. I'll put aside what the California law actually provides or doesn't in this circumstance. I'm just looking at what the jury was asked to find. And point to me where the jury was asked to find that he acted legally throughout.
Well, it says that he had to have 2670 says that they have to find that he
statute says. Tell me what the instruction says.
No, the instruction, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about CalCrim 2670.
Right.
He had to have acted lawfully. It doesn't say throughout, but it also doesn't say you have to apply it at four different or at any certain number of different.
I know the statute doesn't say that, but you submitted a jury instruction asking the jury to find that. So I'm not sure if we have to worry about what statutes generally provide or don't provide. The jury was said illegality will occur at one of four points. And the officer has a defense. I assume he doesn't have a defense to the parts where he wasn't acting illegally. officer will have a defense if he shows what 2670 shows. So when I put those two together, I just don't think the jury was ever asked to find whether he acted legally during those portions of the transaction that they didn't find that Ms. Lemos acted illegally.
Well, if you go back to 2656, where they lay out those four different potential actions, that instruction doesn't say, and with respect to one, you need to say, you know, you need to show that she violated
number one. The last one of those, at the end of that instruction, says you may not find that the defendant guilty unless you all agree that the people have proved that the defendant committed at least one of the alleged acts of resisting, obstructing, or delaying a police officer who was lawfully performing his duties. And you all agree on which act the defendant committed. So the lawfully is directly connected to one of the alleged acts of resisting, obstructing, or delaying.
That's not the way I read the instruction. The instruction says that you have
to read it verbatim. Take a look and tell me where she's wrong.
Mr.
Oswald. Well, I think it depends on how you read it. So you're right that it says that you have to show that she committed at least one of the alleged acts of resisting, obstructing, and delaying a peace officer, and then
lawfully performing his or her duties.
Doesn't say during each of those separate acts that are being specified, and as well, instruction refers you to 2670, and 2670 is just saying that you have to find that he was acting lawfully.
Well, this is Judge Callahan. I think you have to concede, looking at the case law, there's a different argument if it had just been the general 148 and not specific acts. Then I think you can read the other instruction to show that the officer, that whatever they found 148, whatever the 148 was based on, the officer was acting lawfully. When you break it down, I have to agree with my colleagues that are saying it. When you read those two instructions together, it says they couldn't find her guilty unless whatever act they agreed upon, he was acting lawfully at that time. But I think you have to concede, based on the case law out there, that there are circumstances when there can be a 148, but there can be a separate factual context for the purpose of when you're looking at HEC. Like, for example, hypothetically, let's say you say the whole thing was continuous until she's down on the ground and she's handcuffed. All right, let's just accept that for the moment. But let's say after she's handcuffed, she's not moving at all, then she gets taken over to the car and the officer slams her head into the door. Are you saying that would be HEC barred?
No, that's the Hooper case. That's the Smith case. That's, in fact...
To concede that there can be situations where it's not, that it can be parsed out factually.
Absolutely. And I thought actually Yount was very instructive on that, in that Yount basically said at one point, says the court held that the defendant's acts were part of one continuous transaction involving the officer's efforts to effect his arrest and cannot be separated into phases. That was Yount at 698. But then after that occurs,
I guess what you're not conceding is if it's not one continuous act until she's slammed down and handcuffed, and you parse it out otherwise, then there could be an argument if the 148 was based on something that occurred before she goes down and eats grass and is handcuffed, that if that could possibly not be HEC barred. But you're saying it's one continuous until she hits the ground.
Well, correct. And I'd like to address that, the factual scenario that we're talking about. I keep talking about, was there a break in the conduct? And the way it's being described is, well, there was a break because Deputy Holton was successful in de-escalating to some extent, so she calms, I mean, I wouldn't call it calm, but she stops her behavior to the same extent it had been before, but her conduct throughout this entire 10-minute event was you can't break it into piecemeal parts. The incident was never under control.
Except
she never
complied with the jury instructions. Did break it into piecemeal parts. This is Judge Berzon again. The jury instructions did break it into piecemeal parts. I mean, that seems to me to be her somewhat insuperable problem in this case. It might have gone the other, been treated all as one, and then we have a different problem. But this case is not one where it went to the jury that way. It could have, maybe, and then we'd have a different issue. But it didn't.
No, I understand that the instruction has those four.
So how do we as judges now step by and say, we're going to ignore what the jury did, and we're going to decide for ourselves whether it was one continuous act or not?
Well, what you need to look at the holding in Beats. Look at the holding. I mean,
let me ask the question a little differently and see if it helps you in your response. Let's assume for a moment that we were applying principles of issue preclusion, collateral estoppel, and forget mutuality, same parties in both cases. What issue preclusive effect would the verdict in the first case have on the second one?
Can you get the
sure.
first
but
case?
You have to assume that the criminal case comes down and you have a verdict based on these instructions, and then forget heck for a moment. I'm just talking about issue preclusion. Ms. Lemos sued the same defendant, so don't worry about mutuality. And you could you assert an issue of preclusion bar?
I think you could.
Even though a finding on any one of the four incidents was not necessary to the jury's verdict. In other words, she's asserting something just on the fourth incident or on this being taken to the ground. And you would not be able to tell from the jury's verdict what was necessary to their conclusion. So it seems to me Judge Fletcher is the real civil procedure professor here, but I sometimes play one on TV. There wouldn't be issue of preclusion under those circumstances, would there?
Well, the issue now, again, is that we're trying to break down what? One act, one count of obstructing into these separate and distinct.
Well, but the jury was given that instruction here. So we wouldn't know from looking at the jury verdict which of the four it relied on. And therefore, under classic issue preclusion principles, we wouldn't be able to find something precluded in the next case on any of those four issues. And so why isn't that the appropriate analysis here?
Well, under Hack and under the case law, Beats, and et cetera, when you have a continued one act like this, you assess the officer's conduct throughout the incident, just like we have in the jury instructions.
Hack says that you don't want to attack the criminal verdict because you don't want to do something contrary to what it necessarily found. That's the words in Heck, necessarily. And those are the same. I think the court probably used that language with some thought because that's what we think of when we think of issue preclusion. Was an issue necessarily decided in the first action? So I'm still trying to figure out how we know the jury decided that your officer acted legally throughout here when it certainly wasn't instructed that it had to find that.
You're addressing the language necessarily imply the invalidity.
Yes.
Imply doesn't mean actually established, does not mean must show invalidity.
What does necessarily mean?
Well,
I think you're taking it out of the sentence. I mean, if you say, "Well, it must imply," and it says
it doesn't
necessarily imply.
Well, there are two ways of reading that. You could say does not necessarily actually establish. Necessarily imply is not the same. Imply is it's just not the same.
Mr. Osmond, it doesn't say. This is Mary Judge Marquette. It doesn't say might imply. It says necessarily implies.
I understand. But it doesn't say necessarily shows the invalidity or necessarily must show the invalidity. It's implied, which implied that is not the same.
I want to ask this Judge Berzon a question that I asked your opposing counsel, which is, remember that we are sitting on bank, so what Beetz and Smith and so on exactly say we can clarify or change. And I've, in thinking about this, have wondered about the assumption that's being made that if we were talking about the takedown incident, that there would be a heck bar. I don't really understand that because, again, what went to the jury here specifically with regard to that takedown was, if it even went to the jury, which as Judge Fletcher suggested, but assuming it did, was that she pulled her arm away when he tried to stop her when she was walking into the house, not resisting arrest during the takedown. So why is the any excessive force during the takedown, why is that the relevant lawful behavior? It's after the event that was asserted to be the 148A violation.
It's not after, it's really the culmination. You have this conduct throughout the event. It's part and parcel of a continuous event. You can't break it into pieces.
I'm trying to give you a break, so to speak, by saying let's just focus on the takedown event. Let's not worry about whether it was continuous.
Okay, I didn't understand.
Not worry about whether it was continuous before that. Let's just focus on the takedown event. Still, what went to the jury as the triggering factor there was pulling her arm back when he tried to grab her. And there was no instruction with regard to any resistance during the takedown. So then why is any excessive force during the takedown anything that the jury would have had to determine when it decided, even as to the pulling back at that stage, whether the officer was acting lawfully?
Well, I mean, I think because as she's pulling the arm back, that's as he is grabbing hold of her, and it's his entire core. I mean, that's all part of the arrest. He's grabbing onto her arm, he's taking her down, and...
Well, actually, he said he took her down because she pulled back. I don't quite see the connector. I do have another question. Do you agree that the Deputy Horton was quite clear that what he was arresting her for was her earlier delays and instructions?
Yeah, he indicated that he wanted to, it was his intention to arrest her from the very start, just about when she bumps into the gun side of his body, that he saw that as a criminal act and that he intended to arrest her at that point.
But also that's what he did arrest her for, not for resisting arrest during the force incident.
Well, again, it's a course of conduct. She could have been arrested for... She was arrested for resisting arrest, and there was a course of...
No, she was arrested for violating 148A, which doesn't necessarily involve resisting arrest.
Okay, resisting, obstructing, delaying the officer's duties.
This is Judge Fletcher. Let me change this just a little bit. Let's assume that the jury was instructed that it could find her guilty on any of the four, and then the jury comes back and says, we find her guilty on number one. We find her guilty because she made physical contact with the deputy as he was trying to open the truck door. Then the verdict comes back. Does that change your argument?
I don't think it does.
So if that doesn't change your argument, let me ask you the following. Why does it necessarily imply the invalidity of that conviction that 5 minutes later he uses excessive force on her when there has been a substantial, and this is even on your view of the law, there's been a substantial interruption during which she does not interact with him at all. She then walks past him on the way back to the house. She grabs he grabs at her, she pulls away, Henry takes her down. How does excessive force at the end of that, 5 minutes afterwards, how does that imply the invalidity of the conviction for, number one, physical contact as he tried to open the door?
It's very much like in the Beats case, where it's a continuum of conduct.
No, the Beats case is illegal conduct until he and it ceases exactly when he's shot.
This one, and with Ms. Lemos, the entire incident, she was never obeying orders. She was never under control. She's fleeing back up to the residence, and he tapped
her. I'm not sure that quite answers my question. The jury has convicted her of violating 148A because she made physical contact with him at the door. 5 minutes later, she walks past him. He grabs her arm. She pulls away. He takes her to the ground and grinds her face on the gravel. Why is the finding that that's excessive force 5 minutes later, why does that imply the invalidity of the conviction for obstructing 5 minutes earlier by bumping against him as he tried to open the door? I don't get it.
Well, I think it's an argument about the facts here, really, because they're what I'm trying to point out is
did I misstate the facts?
Well, you stated them differently than I view the facts, and I think differently than the district court had viewed the facts. And
how would you state the facts? There's not 5 minutes of separation between making physical contact at the door and the takedown?
There are 5 minutes between those events, but during that time, the situation is never calm. It has never been put under control.
What is this, Judge Berzon? It seems to me the arguments you're making are relevant to the ultimate excessive force case if it goes to summary judgment or to the jury. I mean, what you're saying is all of these facts are relevant to whether there was excessive force in the end. But we're talking heck bar here. We're not talking the ultimate excessive force question, Fourth Amendment question. So can you separate those out and tell us why on Judge Fletcher's hypothetical as a heck bar question, not as a question of whether there might be excessive force or whether or not it be qualified immunity, the jury verdict would not be determinative?
No. I thought I had answered the question, and maybe I'm just not being clear on this. But if you're talking about the first action and why the excessive force 5 minutes later would be considered to be a heck bar. Let's take that action at the end. Because this is a continuous act, and I know we have a dispute over whether it's actually a continuous act, but you have these four events that are part of that continuous act. When he takes her down, that force when taking her down is actually applicable to that first one, that second one, that third one, all of the ones in between. So,
but Mr. Rothman, so I mean, is it your view then? I mean, suppose you have a situation. Maybe not so hypothetical. The officer is acting reasonably. A person obstructs him. And then that's a completed violation of 148, isn't it, at that moment? Like the officer has not used excessive force, but he's obstructed. The person doing the obstructed has now violated 148, right?
That's absolutely right.
A couple minutes later, the officer acts, does something unreasonable, uses excessive force. That doesn't undo the completed violation of 148, does it?
No, but the officer's conduct is temporal. It's temporally indistinguishable from any of those acts. It's not like the one act occurred and then the officer, he's trying to deal with the situation. He's trying to bring it under control. He's trying to arrest her throughout this incident. And then he uses the force, and it's some 10 minutes late or something like that.
Right, but it sounds like the position you're now taking is that a determination that the later use of force was unreasonable somehow reaches back in time and invalidates the earlier 148 violation. Why, if that's not what you're saying?
No, I think that is what I'm saying.
Can I play with Judge Fletcher's hypothetical for you? Let's assume that rather than having found that the first incident was where Ms. Lemos acted illegally, the jury was given interrogatories and found that the first incident was she'd acted illegally, but she did not act illegally with respect to incidents 2, 3, and 4. Would there be a heck bar with respect to incident 4?
Yeah, there would be a heck bar.
No matter what the jury said, no matter what finding of fact was made in the first trial, let's assume this had been in 4 counts, and the jury found her innocent of the fourth, would your position still be the same?
No. I don't think it would be heck bar.
What's the difference between that and special interrogatories in which they find that the first incident gave rise to a conviction, but the next three did not?
Because here we have specific jury instructions that are saying that they're 36, 70, or 50, whatever the number was, 2650, or 2670, which says that you have to find that the law officer acted lawfully.
So we would disregard, in your view, we disregard the jury verdict in that case and nonetheless impose a heck bar.
Yeah.
I think, since you don't know criminal law, I'm going to, having done criminal law and been a trial judge, and I'm going to come back to Mr. Schweiger on this. I think that the prosecution probably could have charged different acts, more than one 148. All right. And then the question would have been, and like they said, maybe it wasn't a 148 at one point, and it was a 148 at another point. That wasn't what happened here. But my guess is going to be, and Mr. Schweiger, I think, will be out, he was there. I'm thinking that there was a discussion and said, what are you, there's a whole bunch of conduct that goes on. These women are yelling, they're swirling around, they're saying you can't, you know, they're arguing the Fourth Amendment, saying you can't ask her to get out of the car, X, Y, and Z, that, and probably ask the prosecution, what acts are you relying on? What are you going to argue to the jury about what constitutes a 148? That's why the defense didn't, and the prosecution said, hey, I'm not going to argue that when they questioned his interpretation of the Fourth Amendment, that wasn't the 148 or whatever. These are the things I'm going to argue comprise the 148. The defense didn't object to that. But let's say it had been broken out, and Mr. Schweiger, I'm going to ask you this, if it had been 4 different acts of 148, and let's say they were found, and she was found guilty on every single one of them, then the argument that he was acting lawfully during all of those is a much stronger argument. But then the prosecution comes in and say, I want you to be, it's 4 different acts, sentence you consecutively. Then, Mr. Schweiger, you would say, oh, no, it's one continuous act, Your Honor. She should only be sentenced one time. So all of what we're talking about on the jury instructions, I think that there was more that went on between the lawyers and the court, and that Mr. Schweiger perhaps asked, okay, what are you going to say, what conduct of what we have here is the 148? They put it in there, and then here we are. So, but you don't know criminal law, so you don't have to answer it. But I've set it up for Mr. Walker.
Well, you're out of time, Mr. Osmond. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Schweiger, you had some time left.
This is Judge Callahan. You know criminal law. So tell me what happened there. Did you ask to say, what is 148 behavior out there? Because you have a lot of minutes. I think we all watched the videos, and you know, we probably all have different views of how the women behaved, but they, in my view, they were pretty obstreperous and pretty threatening. And if you listen to the video, the officer seems a lot more out of breath than your client was at the end of the, I mean, he's breathing pretty hard after the struggle. But did you ask to say, what are you relying on for 148 out of all of this?
I'm sure that that discussion was had, Your Honor. If I had the specifics in mind, I would certainly tell you at the court. I do recall
I'm not totally out to lunch about what might have happened there.
I recall specifically the conversation with the court. And again, I don't believe this is on the record, but specifically that we had concerns that the verbal protestations would be considered resisting, obstructing, or delaying by the jury unless they were instructed that that's not what the prosecutor was going for. And I believe that was the genesis of the conversation about what are the acts that comprise 148 here.
Okay, hypothetically, if they had been four different 148s, let's just say your client was charged with four different 148s and she was found guilty of all of them, would you have argued at sentencing that it was one continuous act and she shouldn't be sentenced consecutively?
I think that would be supported by Penal Code Section 654, Your Honor. So, yes, I would have made that argument. But I do believe that the argument regarding charging multiple offenses or being convicted of multiple offenses is not necessarily the same as being sentenced.
So your argument would be that the one continuous on sentencing is different than the one continuous that we make for the HEC bar?
That would be my argument, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for doing criminal law.
Somebody's got to, Your Honor. I do have a few minutes remaining. I would just like to, in summary, state that because we are unable, as HEC requires, to take this criminal conviction, and I haven't necessarily implied that it's invalid if Ms. Lemos were to succeed on her 1983 claim, then HEC is just inappropriate. There's certainly a lot of other issues, and the issues spread a lot farther, frankly, than the case that we're just looking at here. But on the facts of this particular case, we can't say that necessarily the criminal conviction would be implied in full. And so we cannot apply the HEC bar, and the district court's grant of summary judgment, its application of HEC, must be reversed.
Thank you very much for your oral argument presentation. The case of Gabby Lemos versus the County of Sonoma is now submitted. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.